Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let me take you back.
That was called improvisation.
Way back.
Whoa.
Back into time. Rewind!
This is Good. I was hoping we'd do this part two.
You know what we're going to talk about, don't you now?
I don't really, do I? We'll find out. Brothers, sisters, siblings, the listeners have spoken and I have listened. I am barely in this episode. I have taken a bow out due to popular demand. People want to hear from Ready Rich. And once again, maybe I've run into, for the second week in a row, random transportation issues that have prevented me from doing my fucking job as co-host of this show. But it doesn't matter. Penn's got this, so does Ready Rich, and here they are, preaching the love.
Brought to you by
Masterclass. Presented by Masterclass, here's Penn Jillette.
You just got in that Masterclass right at the last instant, didn't you? And we're brought to you by Masterclass. Masterclass.com/Penn. Missed one. For lifelong learning. Boy, it's the greatest thing. If you haven't done it yet, go do it. We'll talk about it more during the show. But here we are here once again without Matt Donnelly.
Yep.
And once again, I will remind Matt Donnelly of the toss-ups. You know about the toss-ups, don't you?
I do.
Yeah, well, the toss-ups was my juggling group.
I heard they used to be called the throw-ups.
Yeah, but we didn't get as much work. That was our opening joke, as you know. Probably the first joke I told professionally on stage was how were the toss-ups used to be the throw-ups. And we were Penn Jillette, Mike Motion, and Colin Motion. And we used to go out and do, nursing homes and talent shows and anyone who would have us. And our price at that time, pretty high, I think, actually, was like $15. And Colin Motion was, let's say, neurologically diverse. Shall we say that? The three of us would go out and do these juggling shows. And then one day, Mike Motion, who eventually would win the MacArthur Grant for Genius Juggler, decided he wanted to go to golf practice at the high school instead. Our golf course was not a fancy, it was poor people's golf. There's probably another name for poor people's golf. It's a walk, right? And he decided not to come to that show and said, could you guys do the job without me? And Colin and I said yes. We went and did the job. Remember, this is his brother, right? His brother. And I went to split up the money, and I took the $15, and I gave Colin $7.50, and I took $7.50, and he said, I don't think we need Mike anymore. He said, I don't like splitting it three ways. This is better. So here we are. I'm not saying that has anything to do with anything, Reddy. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's a story that popped into my head. You know what I'm saying?
I think I get what you're laying down here.
Matt Donnelly is unable to fly. Which is not a remarkable piece of information, is it? But his airplane is also unable to fly because it's very windy in Vegas. Did you notice how windy it was?
On the way to work last night, I'm pretty sure I saw an old lady riding a bicycle in the sky.
You also hit a tumbleweed, didn't you?
I hit a tumbleweed on the highway.
What was that like?
I don't know. Do you have this? Every time I see a tumbleweed, still, I laugh.
Yeah, me too.
Because they're not real. They're made for Looney Tunes.
Yeah, they're made for Looney Tunes. And even if they're not made for Looney Tunes, they're made for really cheesy Westerns. Now, what is the deal? What is the tumbleweed deal? That was my Seinfeld, by the way. What is the tumbleweed deal? I can't even say it.
I don't know.
But is that a way that they propagate? They propagate through tumbling? I mean, I do. Yeah, you thought they were just an imaginary thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so
I still feel it's an imaginary thing. When I see them, I am sure that...
You think it's a performance art thing, someone put it in there, or you think you're hallucinating?
It's where I first started believing we're in a simulation.
But let's imagine that tumbleweeds are real. By the way, That's the first line of my Stax single. Let's imagine tumbleweeds are real. That was my general Stax lead vocal, you know, Sam and Dave, Otis Redding, kind of all mixed up there. Pictured Donald Duck Dunn playing bass and Steve Cropper on guitar.
Horn section?
Yeah, of course there's a horn section. And something they do a little grace note that's uncalled for. I always love that in the Stax horn parts, when he goes like, bow, 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 you know, that thing. I also, what I think is really, really funny and got me thinking was when Sam and Dave broke up, Dave found it because they hated each other. I mean, almost instantly, they loathed each other. So they broke up, and Dave couldn't get work. So he found another singer named Sam and tried to book them as Sam and Dave because they actually were Sam and Dave. Now, that's a complicated lawsuit. But what it got me musing about was how many people have the name Teller. That's what it got me musing about. But I guess you could legally change your name, right? I mean, Garfunkel could find, it's easy to find someone named Simon, like maybe one of the Chipmunks. If there is Simon and Garfunkel out there and it's one of the Chipmunks and no one has told me, I am extra angry, extra, extra, extra angry. But I was thinking that maybe tumbleweeds, I mean, they don't live, I mean, one of the things you hear is that in all these years of evolution, evolution has never discovered the wheel, right? That's said a lot of times.
I have never heard that said until this moment.
Okay. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? What I'm trying to think is, did tumbleweeds discover the wheel?
I'll remind everybody that I've lost my eidetic memory over the last 5 years. So maybe I have heard this.
Anybody write in about tumbleweeds?
No.
Okay. Because I'm thinking that maybe that trope that you never heard, making it a pretty unsuccessful trope, that evolution never came up with the wheel. Is it possible that tumbleweeds are evolution come up with the wheel? I mean, what I am imagining, and I think the best biology is imagined by me. Hear that, Emma Stone? In my mind, if tumbleweeds were real, I think that they probably propagate by when they go to seed, they just roll somewhere until those seeds lay down and grow other tumbleweeds. Do tumbleweeds exist in a green form? All of this could be answered so easily by Wikipedia.
Which we're not going to do today.
No, we're not going to do that. The first time I lived in Vegas, the first time I saw a tumbleweed, I was helpless with mirth.
I still am. Even if it scratched up my car.
Are tumbleweeds, how do they feel? That's but what Bob Dylan was really talking about when he wrote "Like a Rolling Tumbleweed" was how does it feel?
It's like a dead bush in the shape of a sphere.
Dead bush in the shape of a sphere. Boy, that's the name of our concept album. Everything seems so artistic to me today. Someone very kindly, Matthew Doran is who it was actually, very kindly sent in some Chipmunks tracks slowed down. Now, this is from the later Chipmunks when they did punk. He sent me Call Me, Blondie's Call Me, done by the Chipmunks at the speed it was recorded. And I got to tell you, I really liked it. You heard me playing it, right?
I did.
And I really like that sluggish quality. I find that when all is said and done in music, the tempo that I love is that downed out heroin tempo that like Neil Young does on Harvest and Lou Reed does on Jesus and Pale Blue Eyes. All those downed out heroin tempos really, really like. I was thinking about Dr. John, who, you know, was on heroin. Mac Rebenack, who later performed as Dr. John, was a, and this is not, I'm not giving information that's unknown because otherwise I wouldn't know it, was a heroin addict for 30 years. And he tried LSD and he tried speed. And he said he really, really didn't like them because he liked drugs that kept him low and slow and down. And I think were I to be a drug addict, which I think is right around the corner, I've come so close. I do like cough syrup, and I like morphine. So I think my drug of choice would be Down and Out. What do you think? What would you do?
Have we talked about my childhood dentist before?
No, let's talk about childhood dentist.
So we lived in a rural area. There were no options on dentist, just the one local guy.
My dentist was named Bontempi. Good time.
I'm going to not name my guy.
For reasons that will be all too clear.
Yeah.
And maybe already are clear.
He's an alcoholic. You didn't want to show up on Monday because he'd be hungover. Somebody had to go on Monday, and sometimes that was me. And when he was in that condition, he got a little loosey-goosey with laughing gas.
Oh, did he? And did you have a lot of laughing gas?
Too much laughing gas. And also, he listened to the psychedelic rock station.
Really?
So it was Pink Floyd, Alan Parsons, Led Zeppelin, all that stuff.
While you were high on laughing gas.
Which already has reverb plenty in it.
Yeah.
And then you've got the extra reverb from the laughing gas.
Does laughing gas give you reverb?
Yeah.
Verb?
It gives you echoes.
Echoes. Were you also giggly and high?
And I did not like that feeling.
You didn't?
I didn't.
So you'd be more down guy too, you think?
So I've never even considered it.
Because of Dr. Laughing Gas.
I had the bad experience there, and then I also grew up in my grandfather's tavern, so I saw guys get old and die off of booze. And I just never wanted any of it.
I don't think I have much interest in alcohol of any kind. I don't think so. But if I were exploring drugs, I think acid first, and then go right to heroin, and then I'm done, right?
But I can talk about the groove.
We're talking about the groove.
You're talking about that heroin tempo.
Yeah.
In the music. Do you know Band of the Hand theme song from Bob?
Yeah.
It was an 80s movie.
Yeah.
Is that your tempo?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Bob does a lot of stuff on Blonde on Blonde. I mean, Visions of Johanna, if you want the absolute pinnacle of the music I always want. If I had listened to one song for the rest of my life, it would probably be Visions of Johanna. I get something different out of it every time. It's right at that tempo. And you know when your year thing comes up on Apple Music? I don't know if you use Apple Music.
I don't.
They do your songs for every year.
I see people post those on social media. Yeah.
And Visions of Johanna for me is like number one all the time. And Stone Soul Picnic for some reason. I listen to Stone Soul Picnic a lot. Laura Nero's version, not the Fifth Dimension version, which is something that troubles Glenn to no end.
But you would know the list without them giving it to you, right?
No, I'm always a little surprised. Because sometimes I fall asleep to the Grateful Dead. So in my list are Dead songs, and that always startles me.
Why are they in your list?
Because I fall asleep to them. So Apple remembers you listen to these.
On purpose?
I do, yeah. Sometimes the Grateful Dead puts me to sleep.
Huh.
You don't think so?
I would imagine that would just put you on such edge that you wouldn't be able to sleep.
Well, this is what I was talking about to Eddie Gordetsky. And boy, Jonesy doesn't get this. Jonesy gets mad at me for saying this. Eddie Gordetsky always says, I don't like to think about the music. I don't like that I have music that I've missed because of the wrong haircut. Right? I know that's an important concept. You know, you just dismiss out of hand. And he said to me, we were having lunch the other day, coffee, and he said to me, actually Italian sodas, wonder what we were really having Italian sodas at Madhouse Coffee. And I love Madhouse Coffee. He said, the Grateful Dead have 10 great songs. There are 10 great songs by the Grateful Dead. And that is undoubtedly true for Celine Dion. It's undoubtedly true for Billy Joel, certainly. I don't listen too much. 10 great songs in there. There's no doubt about it. Phil Collins, who I really don't care for at all, certainly 10 great songs. So there is a lot of music we miss because of the... You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to read. I'll do this. This is a good time to do this. I hadn't even thought about doing this, but I'm going to do it now. There is... I was asked by Andrew Hickey to write an intro to the second of his books about music, the 500 songs. He asked me to write that. And I did write that. I think I'm going to read it to you. I don't know if I have rights to do this. I think I gave it to Andrew Hickey. So this is probably in some way violating an agreement, which I think is very important for our show. I'll read this, okay? Andrew Hickey Forward. This is his book that'll cover the 50 songs from 100 to 150, which is Telstar to All You Need Is Love. Back in the 1930s or 1940s, there was a notoriously difficult physics professor named Fritz Zwicky. He worked on impossible astrophysics problems like gravity lenses and dark matter, a very smart cat. His students at Caltech complained about Professor Zwicky to the other physics professors. They said that Zwicky's assignments were just too hard for them. Their marks were too low. The students and profs got together and came up with a cockamamie scheme to fuck with old Fritz. The following years, the students and the other profs created a fake student. All this phony student's assignments were done by the other professors, all working together. Finally, there was a student that was doing well in the impossible course. Professor Zwicky wanted to meet him, but of course, this stellar student never attended a class. Just before the final exam, Zwicky discovered he'd been scammed, and the old curmudgeon was furious. It may not be wise to piss off someone that smart. When time came for the final exam, after all the students, the real ones, had sat down, Fritz took a quarter out of his pocket and spun it on the table in front of the class. A minute or so later, when the quarter came to rest, Professor Zwicky said, "Analyze the motion," and left the room. Fuck them. There was a legendarily dense German book on this one motion problem. It has two volumes. Motion problems include difficult ideas like this. The pole hold rolls without slipping on the herp pole hole lying in the invariable plane. Anyone can spin a quarter. Explaining it is a whole different thing. Spinning a quarter on a table is a little easier than spinning a rock record on a turntable. Listening to bebop or classical may be a bit harder, like spinning several quarters at once, and listening to 20th century 12-tone German opera might be like spinning a plutonium coin the size of a refrigerator. But no matter, spinning is easier than reporting and analyzing. To explain anything is wicked hard. Popular music in the last half of the 20th century was pretty much what we now call rock music. I used to think I had a rocker's soul, but I've grown to understand that I don't. There is nothing innate. I was just alive at the right time. The records were spinning and vibrating the air, so I listened. Music grabs us at every level. My buddy, Eddie Gorodetsky, says we can't judge any music 2 years plus or minus our first sex act. Music and sex become the same thing. We can't be objective. We don't want to be objective. It's primal and it's intellectual at the same time. Music is part of who we are. It hits us everywhere at once. Music tells us about our lovers, our friends, our tribes, our hopes, our dreams, our failures, our countries, our politics, and maybe most importantly, how to style our hair. Music is an art form, but it's also a commodity. We seek out some music, but it's also just there. It's the air. We have so much less control over individual taste than it seems. I loved the Monkees, Dylan, the Beatles, Donovan, the Turtles, Tiny Tim, the Who, Lou Reed, David Bowie, Jonathan Richman, the Ramones, the Sex Pistols, Blondie, etc. I used to think of that as my taste. I thought it showed something about my personality. It really meant I was born in 1955. We all take our different little musical side trips, whether that's the Mothers, Sun Ra, Patti Smith and the Residents, or just cowboy hat shit. It doesn't matter. We go our own ways, but we all start by listening to what we all start listening to. That's what popular means. Andrew Hickey took the spinning assignment seriously. In this book from episodes 101 to 150 of the podcast, A History of Rock Music and 500 Songs, from Telstar to All You Need Is Love, he is studying the vibrating air that we all share. His scholarly research is commendable enough to make this book interesting. His integrity makes it valuable. His insights make it indispensable. and his empathy and compassion make it beautiful. My friends think I know a bit about music. I have thousands of vinyl records. I've gone to a lot of shows. I've played some music. I've worked with and been very close friends to some of the people who feature prominently in Andrew's podcast. But this podcast changed my mind on music in so many ways. I was a smug rock snob who thought I knew some shit. Andrew proved me wrong on so many things, and I love him for that. There's no greater gift an artist can give us than to change us. Now I'm a smugger, rockier, and snobbier. That's how much I've learned. He also taught me about kindness and compassion. He taught me about culture and history. He changed my mind on cultural appropriation, copyright groove infringement, and other things too numerous and embarrassing to mention. I'm saving the best for last. I could make a list of the dozens, soon to be hundreds of artists that Andrew's podcast hit me to and or changed my perspective on. Every episode inspires me and broadens my taste and my heart in amazing ways. But there's one gift he gave me that others have tried to give me and failed. Andrew gave me Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys. I was the right kind of rock snob asshole to know that I knew I was supposed to dig them, and I had the records, but I was a Dylan Zappa guy, and I thought Brian Wilson was too pretty and too simple. I never really understood the lyrics, and I never was able to hear the music directly. Music that was about as simple as that spinning coin at Caltech. Two volumes of dense German physics about a spinning quarter are nothing compared to the hundreds of hours about spinning records in a dense Manchester accent, an accent much harder to understand than German, which is why I think we need the book. In this book, Andrew will explain your life to you while making it better. Spin it, my friend. That's what I wrote. And it does talk a lot about that whole thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That whole thing that you miss stuff like The Dead might have some good songs.
There was a book about, was it Celine that you read
a
few years ago?
Let's Talk About Love.
It's in the same area.
Yeah. Although that one is more a dialectic, you know, and less of a overall view.
So I'm going to ask you a question and our friendship might hinge on this.
Okay. Well, I'd like you to ask in the right form. Riddle me this, Cape Crusader.
Riddle me this, Mr. Fledermausmensch?
Mr. Fledermausmensch. So, yeah.
Is that right?
Herr Fledermausmensch.
You said you don't like Phil Collins as a musician. How do you feel about him as an engineer?
You mean the fact that his snare sound is the only snare sound we heard from, what, 89?
12 years?
Yeah. It's certainly, sonically, the records are beautiful, right?
Yeah.
It's just really beautiful.
And everybody that he produced as well.
But I know that snare sound is just, it is for that 12 years, is it?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Like 81 to?
Oh, it's earlier than I thought.
About 93 when, as grunge was taken over, it went away.
Mm. But that was what everybody thought a snare drum sounded like.
Yeah.
It's always so startling. When I played drums, I liked the snare drum sound to be incredibly crisp. I just liked that sound, you know, very piccolo, very sharp. But lately, especially because of jazz, you hear those more resonant, more wood-sounding, thicker, looser tuned, lower pitched. I just said the same thing twice. Snare drums, even that kind of gong, gong. When Ringo Starr's snare drum always bothered me because it had a clunk to it that I didn't enjoy. But I think I was wrong. I think I'm trying to like it now.
Yeah, even the hairband guys were doing Phil's drum techniques.
Mm-hmm. I mean, were they recording it, not putting it as a sample?
You could put Def Leppard and the Cars were produced by the same guy, Mutt Lange. You put them back-to-back, those albums, and it's the exact same structure and snare sound and EQ on everything all the way through. We're about to go into a deep well here. I might drive you crazy.
Now, have you ever done recording? I mean, I know you're doing recording right now as we speak. We are speaking into a recording. But, I mean, have you ever recorded a band?
I did hip-hop stuff in the 90s.
For artists?
Yeah, but it was not a live band. It was all program stuff. scratch DJs and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever wanted to do a whole? Well, you do live mixes, right?
I do live stuff.
And that's similar.
And that's where we're about to get in a dangerous area. I've been studying Dave Ratt, who is Red Hot Chili Peppers audio guy for a long time. And he solved the problem of combing in live venues.
What's combing?
Are you familiar with this?
No.
So if you imagine you throw a pebble into water and where it lands, you get the ripples coming out from it. If you throw two out at the same time, same size, they interfere with each other at the same rate.
Mm-hmm.
You see those waves bang into each other. Yeah. When you've got left and right stereo. Out of phase in different spots, right? Because you've got the same signal bashing into itself multiple times. And where you are in relationship to those waves, you're seeing a different signal coming back to you.
Yep.
You could visualize that, right?
Yep.
So the same thing's going on if you've got stuff in a stereo mix that's mono mixed to the center.
Mm-hmm.
The audio waves are hitting each other the same way, and you're getting that same effect, and it's called combing. If you look at it on a waveform guide, it looks like the teeth of a comb.
I see.
That's why they call it that. But you hear it. It sounds weird. As you move around the room, it gets crazy.
And how do you solve it?
And he solved it by making sure that he's never mixing mono to the middle. It's completely separate signals on both sides. So he'll take the DI from the bass and the mic from the bass. And one goes all the way to the left, one goes all the way to the right. Snare top, snare bottom, all the way to the left, all the way to the right. And I've always liked this. I preferred the snare bottom for my live mixes, but it sounds so much better now that I'm doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And you can move around the room and hear it different. And you don't get the combing effect.
Oh, that's nice. That's really smart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it also gives you, if you're way over audience left, you're actually hearing a very different mix than if you're audience right.
Right. And his answer to that was, well, when I was growing up and hanging out with garage bands, well, the thing that I loved doing was moving around the garage and hanging around with the different guys and seeing what they were doing.
Yeah.
And now you could do that in the room as well.
Well, some of that Jamaican stuff, too, where the band would play and the guy would just play with the faders.
Uh-huh.
So bring up the bass super loud, bring other people down. I wish they did that more. I wish they gave audio guys, like, would you like to see the Stones guy just going, oh, let's listen to just Keith for a little bit. Now there's just Ronnie. Now let's hear just the kick drum. And just bring everything way down. No live band does that, right?
Not one person at a time. No.
Right. But I mean, not really letting the mix shift during the song.
Correct.
Yeah. People would probably hate it. Otherwise, it would be done, right?
Yeah, well, I think it changed after the Beatles stereo records.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had the instruments on the left and the vocals on the right.
Yeah.
And you go into a grocery store that's playing that, and they've only got the left channel.
Yeah.
And there's no vocal.
Yeah. I remember used to listen to that and just go, boy, that's so strange. So strange.
So they stopped doing that kind of stuff to solve those kind of problems at the wholesale level.
Now, see, this is the kind of lifelong learning. A lot of people listening going, I didn't think I would talk at all today about 12-tone German opera. And I didn't think I'd talk at all about combing in the Chili Peppers audiences. But I'm dedicated to lifelong learning. Watch this. It's going to be great. And if you really care about lifelong learning, see that? You should consider Masterclass. Masterclass has over 180 instructors, and they are the best instructors in every subject. I mean the best in the world, the best that ever lived. For instance, you got Steve Martin and you've got Ron Howard. But just to give an example of the best in the world, who does the Masterclass magic thing? Do you happen to know?
A couple guys.
Mm-hmm.
A little older.
Is it two different guys?
Two different guys together.
Are they two different acts?
No. They work together.
Oh, one act. That'd be Siegfried and Roy, right?
No, they're dead.
Oh, I see. So that would be, there's those two Swedish guys. What are they called? They got a show on Broadway that's opening, or off Broadway, it's opening now. Or it's the guy that produces that show, right? It's Payne and Penn and Teller, right?
Penn and Teller.
We do that. The stuff is beautifully produced. I've said this, Masterclass. I've said this before, but what's interesting is when you work with Masterclass, they learn from you what you want to teach. and then they figure out a way to teach it. It's often said, if you want a professor to really teach you, or even a music teacher, you can't have someone who's too good because they don't remember what it's like to not know it. You know that?
Mm-hmm.
It's really a fascinating idea. So Richard Feynman might not be the best professor you could get for particle physics because he doesn't remember what it's like to not know. And what Masterclass does that's so brilliant is the directors and producers know exactly what it's like to not know because they didn't know 3 weeks ago. So you've got your experts, your world-class experts, then filtered through someone who helps them teach it, you know? So it's a beautiful thing. You can learn a lot. What one have you been listening to lately?
I don't want to talk about one that I've been listening to lately, partly because my notes are in there,
mm-hmm.
but partly because I did the Rage Against the Machine guy, Tom Morello, a while back. And I think that ties into what we're talking about in the show proper here.
What'd you learn from Rage Against the Machine?
He talks a lot about doing stuff wrong on purpose and fixing it until it's right for you, mm-hmm. and not that it's right for everybody else. So don't copy Phil Collins' drum.
Mm-hmm.
Use the wrong microphone, use the wrong drum, and make that sound good.
Boy, that's real. The idea of changing and editing to get what you want is really fascinating. When someone asks me about how to write, I say, just write anything, anything, and then start fixing it. Just stream of consciousness, just write it. And you know what I learned recently, speaking of lifelong learning? You know who transcribed the Lenny Bruce routine that got him busted in San Francisco? You know who the archivist transcriber was that was hired to type it actually in?
I'm going to just guess Joan Rivers.
Jerry Garcia.
Nice.
Which is odd, which is why you're missing all the L's, because he's missing that finger. I don't know. Anyway, I need to tell you, I guess, that Masterclass is in every form. You can listen in different orders. Once you have a membership, you get to listen to everything. It's just the greatest thing in the world. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/pen. That's get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/pen. Masterclass.com/pen. That was our best, that was the best keyboard integration we've done on that, don't you think?
At some point, the chat has asked me, how do you type in the glissando in the website?
Mm-hmm. I don't use my, you know, didn't Jerry Lee Lewis use the back of his thumb?
Is that the Marx brother?
Chico.
He was using the back of his, like the back of his pinky, right?
Yeah.
And then point his index?
Yeah. That was going up. Boy, Chico's piano solos are fabulous. Really, really funny. The only person that plays like that I know is Terry Adams, then RBQ. He does kind of Chico Marx, Thelonious Monk, and Sun Ra all together in his piano style. It's really wonderful.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, were doing a live band last night, right?
Yes.
And by doing, I mean mixing.
Correct.
I don't know about the other sense.
I did Side of House last night.
Well, you did Living Color?
No, I went to see Living Color on Thursday.
How were they?
They were great.
You know, I was on a cruise with Vernon. Right?
Yeah.
I was, we were just, it was an amazing cruise because we just had a little lounge of like 30 people, and on stage would be Joe Walsh, Billy Gibbons, and Vernon just playing.
Yeah, he does that thing where you could see his soul leave his body and something else comes in,
mm-hmm.
and takes over.
Yeah, he's really good. I mean, technically, in that style of music, I can't think of someone who's technically better.
It's just him and Eddie, and Eddie's a different thing.
Yeah. But there's another guy that I met, and I forgot his name, who is just not really a performer, not much of a performer, but obsessive to the point of annoying in his carriage, who learned all of Hendrix. I mean, every single move of Hendrix, not the stage stuff, not the fucking the amps and stuff, but the sound. You know, he has the right guitar, the right amp, the right everything, and although it's not left-handed, and he plays note for note Hendrix, which is one thing, but also the sonority is sound for sound exact. And I listened to him and Vernon play Hendrix licks back and forth and also discuss Hendrix licks. And it was fascinating when they would argue about how much a string was bent. I think he bent the string a little less on that, you know? And Vernon can do that. Vernon can just do the Hendrix stuff note for note, move for move. And has such a, I didn't get to talk to him much. I hung out with him for maybe 10, 15 minutes. But such a sweet and kind personality. Just tremendous, a tremendous person. Inspiring to be around. To be that good. And also, he doesn't seem to have, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but he doesn't seem to have any of the trappings you usually see with that kind of skill. All I've just said right there, not an asshole. Did you get that feeling?
Yeah, yeah. They were the opener. Extreme was the headliner. Nuno Bettencourt is also known for being a talented, speedy guitarist. Mm-hmm. I've surpassed my superfluous notes for the week. Whatever my limit is, I went way over it that night. I'm going to shit talk a little bit here.
Okay.
I have never heard somebody on microphone reflect imposter syndrome so much.
The guy in Extreme?
Nuno Bettencourt, yeah. Expressing his near embarrassment that he'd hired Vernon Reid to open for him, and that he now has to follow him.
That's kind of sweet, isn't it?
It's pretty great, isn't it?
That's pretty sweet, yeah.
But it's not Vernon that I want to talk about. I want to talk about Corey.
You know, okay. But I want to say one thing before that. It's really interesting, you know. The Monkees were perhaps the people who invented stadium rock. They were the first to think about playing a stadium, right? Mm-hmm. The Beatles just got bigger amps and put it through the sound system and did their show from Hamburg, really. They didn't do anything. But the Monkees did costume changes. They were on TV. They had money behind them. They did it. So I never realized until just recently that the Monkees were actually a very good stadium band. Did you know that?
I did not.
They played well, and it was a good show. And they had no fear. You know, no band would let Tina Turner or Jimi Hendrix open for them because these guys had done the Chitlin circuit. And we're so much more skilled. Skill breaks down by black and white in 60s bands. Because the 60s, the black performers were playing five shows a day for tough audiences. And they were being weeded out fast. And the white bands were playing for college audiences, one self-indulgent show a night. So when you watch Monterey Pop or you watch Woodstock, the musicianship, although those are wonderful, wonderful performances, the musicianship is not extraordinary. But if you watch, what was the thing that Questlove did, the thing that happened simultaneously to Woodstock in New York?
Don't know.
If you watch that with, you know, Sly and the Family Stone and Fifth Dimension and Otis Redding and so on, the musicianship is so crazy tight. But apparently the Monkees were good enough that they were not scared to have Ike and Tina Turner open for them, which is an incredible Pinocchio story, right? You start out with a drummer who actually can't play, right? A bass player who's actually a piano player and a banjo player, a guitar player who's a serviceable rhythm guitar player, but no more, and another guy that just plays tambourine. And within 2 years, they are able to follow Ike and Tina Turner. It's pretty remarkable. So,
two actors, two musicians,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah. I don't think I would ever consider Vernon Reid to open for me, ever. We're not going to talk about Vernon Reid.
I want to talk about Corey Glover.
Okay.
The singer.
Yeah.
He was not on the boat with you, right? I saw the show the week they got famous for free. They had scheduled at a college in my hometown to play a free show, and their video hit MTV, and they got famous, and they still had to play the free show. It's one of the most amazing shows of my life. Mm-hmm. He's on fire. The first artist that I remember going through the entire facility with a wireless microphone and just a ball of energy. Mm-hmm. But we go back and forth with Jonesy about Melisma.
Yeah.
And every now and then I get almost convinced by him that I hate it all because there's so much bad Melisma out there.
But when Aretha Franklin does it.
And Corey Glover.
Oh, he has that pitch stuff too?
Yeah. I believe he has perfect pitch. I've never heard that. But from the mix that I heard in the house, I couldn't tell where the band was those first two songs. Mm-hmm. It was clear they were running and gunning. They had limited sound check, if that. So I can't imagine his ears were good either. Mm-hmm. And he was just nailing it all the way through.
You know, there's a story about a band. Do you know the story about the band? The exact cusp, that important cusp, when they're playing their last small gig and they've just hit with a video or a single and they become superstars, but it's their last hometown gig. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that they're just going to explode after this. And they're playing their actual hit song that's going to be the one that puts them on the charts and in the public. And they're with their hometown crowd that's the first ones to support them. There's a few hundred people in there, and they're playing this hit song. And the lead singer, as he sings, is thinking, gee, you know, I'm going to finish this gig. I'm going to get really famous. I'm going to stop singing. I'm going to go into acting. I'm going to do a lot of drugs. I'm going to bang a lot of Hollywood stars. This is going to be fabulous. And the guitar player's thinking, gee, I'm going to finish up with this, make it really big. Then I'm going to do a record where I play all the instruments myself. I'm going to just put everything together, make it the sound I want, play a lot of solos, be really, really great. And the drummer's thinking, gee, I'm going to get a bigger kit. I want to get double bass drums. I want a gong. I want three floor toms. I want mounted toms all around. I want timbales, and I want a MIDI trigger over to this side. And the bass player's thinking, G, D.
Doug Wimbish, the bass player for Living Color. I guess I must have known this at some point, but I'd forgotten entirely about it. He was the rhythm section for Sugar Hill Records.
Oh, really?
So all that classic rap stuff.
He played the bass on?
He wrote all those bass lines.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm going to listen to Living Color a lot. Because I don't know anything about them. And I promised myself after I met Vernon Reid that I would do that. And I haven't.
So their big hit's Cult of Personality.
Mm-hmm.
And their second biggest hit is a ballad, Love Rears Its Ugly Head.
Mm-hmm.
During the ballad, a guy passes out in the front of the...
Well, this is last night or Thursday night.
Yes.
Yeah.
Guy passes out and Corey stops the band and gets medical care for the guy.
Mm-hmm.
As the audience part ways for the security and medics to get in.
How does he know? He just sees them.
He just sees it, and he stops the band.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that never happened when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It was always, if there's a crush, if somebody jumps off the balcony, I've had both those happen in my hometown,
mm-hmm.
the medics and security just have to fight the crowd to get there.
Yeah. Well, Altamont is a very good example of that, yeah.
But Altamont, he actually does stop for a while.
He stops kind of. But not the whole band. Keith keeps playing. And Mick's going, who's farting in what for?
People.
Who's farting in what for? Yeah. Boy, did that guy get lucky that that was being filmed. Because you would not have seen that gun otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, so he stopped everything.
Got the guy medical care.
Mm-hmm.
They reset the song, which starts with the track.
Mm-hmm.
Play all the way through again. New solos a second time around.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that this is happening a lot now. I've seen clips on
people passing out.
Whenever there's a problem,
yeah.
The lead singers are now knowing to stop the performance and get it taken care of.
Yeah, well, we've had that happen in our crowd, of course, and we stop the show. And, of course, we don't have people standing, so us stopping the show doesn't change the medical care at all. I saw a nutty thing happen. I was seeing on Broadway – Cuba and his teddy bear. It was a Broadway show. mm-hmm. and it starred Robert De Niro. And I was right in, I think it was in the front row. And it takes place in a lower class kitchen, you know, just the Formica table with the metal side, the refrigerator. And De Niro's there in his Ryder t-shirt without sleeves, looking very much like De Niro looked in the 80s, I guess. I don't know. And it's that kind of dialogue and, you know, very Fool for Lovey, very Sam Shepard-ish, right? De Niro's sitting there and someone has a heart attack in the audience a little ways over from us. There's a line that De Niro is about to do and there's another actor on stage. It's kind of the opposite of what you said, but there's no downside, right? Everybody's seated. The medical people are going to come in. No one's in their way. There's no reason to stop the show except for attention. And I had such a, it was so interesting because this goes on, the whole event, getting EMTs in and getting the person out and safe and all that is probably got to be 15 minutes, right? Maybe 20 for all that to happen. And De Niro has a line to do. And he's got like, I forgot what it was, but some meal in front of him or coffee. I'm remembering coffee and toast, but probably not right. And De Niro stays on stage. I don't think his eyes ever went into the fourth wall. I don't think he ever looked out to see what was happening. He heard it. And he sits there eating his whole meal and thinking about what he's going to say to this guy who is also staying in character. So you have this nutty moment of Annie Baker, you know, Annie Baker who did The Flicks, you know, my favorite play of all time. My favorite playwright is Annie Baker. I could not love her more. And she does shows with these huge pauses. And I find it so fascinating in theater. You know, everybody's so afraid of things getting boring mm-hmm. that we lose this whole deep, deep, rich texture, which I'm trying desperately to move into a bit in the Penn and Teller show. Oh, because you mean you want to excuse the fact that you're not fucking funny and the tricks are boring? Yeah, that's what I mean, asshole. No, it means I'm trying something else. I'm sorry. I had my kind of imposter syndrome just kind of popped up.
Oh, okay. I thought some other asshole had showed up.
So I liked it a lot. I mean, not that someone was suffering, but I liked a lot that there was a reality to it. I mean, a conversation of two people in a kitchen when they're eating could go 15 minutes without talking. That's not unusual, you know? And they both continued. Everything was cleaned up. Everything went. The house lights went down. Well, that's how De Niro knew. The house lights went up. That was it. And the house lights went down. Then De Niro took a bite, another sprig of coffee, and went, yeah, I think, like he'd been thinking about the next line for 20 minutes. Uh-huh. And it was just a really nice moment built on a terrible thing. I mean, I keep thinking that someone's going to think, oh, Penn thinks having heart attacks is a good thing in a theater. No, but I think that a play, there's that famous story that's undoubtedly apocryphal for one of the acting classes, for some like major milestone in acting class, that Brando just ate a sandwich to be actually there. And I was talking to Carrie and she was saying that, you know, one of the cheesy things that all acting teachers do is they'll just put a, you know, poor asshole starting his first acting class, you know, and put him on stage and say, okay, just act. And they never know what to do. You know, they'll start doing mime or something else. They can't just sit there. She said this, of course, as an insult to me. She said that I had done so much performing and I was so oblivious to everything, which I really am, that when Teller's doing stuff on stage, I often completely turn off. She said, what they're trying to get actors to do, you actually do. She said, you'll just wander around and look where you want, you know, and she said, it is the most focus pulling thing you can do, is just to be there. Mm-hmm. Trying to pull focus, mugging and doing that kind of stuff, people can ignore. But someone just looking at the floor, looking at lights. Because lately, you haven't seen the show in a while, but I've decided to wander more. So now I do.
Was there 3 weeks ago?
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
So were you there when I kind of walk upstage with my back to the audience and do some of the monologues to the back scrim?
I don't remember that.
I've been doing that lately, which I think the reason I'm doing it is no artistic reason whatsoever. I think it's because I love how much it annoys Teller and that he can't quite find a way to ask me about it because he thinks that I might have the reaction I'm going to have, which is to pout, and then to pout on stage standing next to him. Teller wisely is it's a battle of will, you know. Will Penn actually do 5 lines as far upstage as he can go with his back to the audience addressing the scrim and looking down? Will he do 6 lines tomorrow night? You know, how far will we go before Teller cracks? So if you want a subtext when you come see the Penn and Teller show, it's there for the taking.
Now, not including the street stuff, have you done like a standing room only show?
Oh, yeah. When we play England, it sells very well, and Australia, and they have different laws. So they fill up the back with standing room.
But not the front?
Not the front, no. We've done, tables and stuff. I've done benefits. Like we did a benefit with Tom Jones and Kiss that I emceed at House of Blues in L.A. That was an entire standing audience. And I've also done stuff with, of course, the Residents and other bands. And I've emceed and walked out and done stuff. And Teller and I have done like local radio rock festivals with like OK Go and stuff where there's 20,000 people and they're all standing. Mm-hmm. And we go out and do 5 minutes, but never anything like you're talking about, I don't think.
But you've, in theory, been responsible for parting the Red Sea if you had to.
Yeah. Well, you know the best story on this, and I it's documented well. I don't know if that means it's not apocryphal, but there was a magician. He was told that there was a fire in the theater and that he should get everybody out of the theater orderly. And he said, for my next trick, would all of you go to the nearest exit as quickly as you can, but carefully, and go out and I will meet you out in the street. And then the way the story's told, it's probably not the way it happened, but it's the way you have to envision it. It's not the way to envision it, that he gets everybody out of the theater safely, and then the theater's on fire, and he goes, ta-da! You know, that's obviously the trick you're going to do. We had a... I've told this before, in the middle of the bullet catch, we had
a magic bullet.
We had a fire alarm, and everybody had to evacuate the theater. And I tried to follow the rules. You know, I was the last one out, telling everyone the last two out. Everybody got out very, very orderly and very nice. And we did shtickla out of the street and then came right back and went back to the magic bullet. It's an amazing thing. When I did street performing, I once had to get a police car into my crowd. Someone had been injured and the police couldn't get around. So I was doing my juggling show and I had probably 500 people outdoors and just went from here over that way, from here over that way. And it really was the parting of that to get a police car in and EMTs. And we also held the crowd, which is phenomenal. There's nothing holding them there. They haven't paid anything. And, you know, there's a thing happening. You'd think they would all run away. But they stayed there, and I finished my show and did my money collection, which is the important part. The show does not exist if there isn't money collecting at the end.
So, change of topic. I have a question for you.
No.
Riddle me this. Herr Flieder muss Mensch.
Thank you.
Last week, I heard you ask the same question 4 times, 4 different occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And you proceeded with, our friendship hinges on your answer to this question.
Yeah.
3 times that was what you said.
Uh-huh.
The 4th time was to me, and you said, a part of our friendship hinges on the answer to this question. Is that the part that is not the director and editor of this show?
There you go.
Just the part that does cool stuff outside of here?
Yeah. So, yeah.
But this part's okay.
I got it. We are going from here. I mean, I assume we're both going from here to Perry Friedman's celebration of life. Is that correct?
Correct.
Boy, I'm it's so hard. You know, it's so hard because I know that a celebration of life is supposed to be different from a funeral. And I love Perry very much. He was a good friend for a long time. I also know that it's for the living. But you know, when
they both are.
Yeah. Of course.
That's a different mood.
Yeah, when Johnny, but it's not a different mood for me. That's my problem. That's what I was going to talk about. You know, for me, they did that Johnny, mm-hmm. The celebration of life. And I went and, you know, I couldn't even talk. I couldn't function, you know, and I remember trying to pull it together and seeing Randy, who I knew we were going to lose.
Would be next. And yeah. He said so on stage. Mm-hmm.
I just find it, I was able to not go to Amazing Jonathan's. I've been invited, aggressively invited by Journey, who runs the comedy museum, and Dick's Mothers, to go to Tommy's celebration of life. And I have a show. That's always what I cling to. And there's a very few of these celebrations of life that chairmen of the board,
attorneys general
that are willing to accommodate me that way. And I'm so grateful. I didn't go to Gilbert's and didn't even watch it. It doesn't seem to mesh with the way I grieve. And the argument, I suppose, is, well, it's not for grieving. It's for celebration. It doesn't mesh in with the way I celebrate either. So I will go because I care very much for Robin, you know, the widow. And it's also fun to see Emily preparing to be a widow. You know, but it's a tough thing. And this one is supposed to be, you know, all the stuff Perry loved, you know, rock, paper, scissors and games and gambling and stuff like that. And those are all things that wasn't part of my relationship with Perry. So the stuff that other people are celebrating is not what my relationship happened to be. So I don't know. Maybe I'll talk to you, right?
Yeah. I think I have some insight on this because I've thought about this a lot as well. You know, we learned the thing from Chris Voss about the palm up instead.
Yeah.
And we've learned from psychology many, many times, if you're upset, smile.
Mm-hmm.
Because your brain doesn't teach your face. Your face teaches your brain. Yep.
And your face stores it too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And all that stuff works.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like people just call it celebration of life in the hopes that it's going to make them feel differently.
Yeah.
And I don't think it does for anybody.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Or maybe it does a little bit. This is really nice because we're just talking about going to Perry's celebration of life.
Oh, good.
Which we're leaving for right now. Matt Donnelly has just come in at appropriate mic motion toss-ups time.
I just want to give the patrons their proper thank you. That's all. I just want to make sure I love them so much. I drove here just to thank the Patreon.
Do you have your story about why you're late? It's just wind, right? There's no story.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I couldn't have caught an earlier flight. Every flight was canceled up until my flight, and then my flight was supposed to leave. But Vegas has been closed for over 24 hours because of wind.
But it's open now?
It is open now, but it was indeed a rough, crazy landing.
Where were you flying in from?
Sacramento, Paris of California.
You know, my friend Karen Russell flew in last night. and said it was just brutal.
Yeah, it's been crazy. Everyone was, a lot of people on my flight were all on canceled flights that were scheduled for my flight.
Mm-hmm. Were you shaken up a bit?
No, physically, yes. Emotionally, tip top.
No, I meant there's a lot of turbulence.
There was, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
As soon you as can't we, talk about this too much. Or
I know, that's why sick. I was trying to, yeah. But I just came in from three shows in Novato, California.
And how did those go?
Very well, very fun. The brand new venue, kind of alternative, weird, like it's like the spa, and they deck it out with like a catering thing in the hallway.
Spa?
Yes.
So you're working in a steam room?
I was working adjacent to a steam room.
Really? Oh, really? Was a joke, and wasn't a joke.
Dream come true, yeah. Just picturing Frankie and Dino. And
did you come out in a puff of steam?
A puff of steam.
In your towel?
In the loincloth. Did a little, I didn't see you there. I see there's a deck of cards over there. I guess I could do something with those, you know?
I needn't say there's nothing up my sleeve.
You know, I mean, I've tried the overalls. Now I've tried the tuxedo. Now just a good towel.
Good towel.
Just a good towel.
But make sure you pin it.
Yeah. No, we don't want to break any laws.
No.
But no.
Well, the audience wants it. But you can't, you were saying is you can't break
Leave them law. Wanting more. Yeah. A little more.
And the shows went well?
Yes.
It was just you, full evening?
Just me, and it was in an intimate parlor setting, so all the close-up stuff I'd been working on, I did a lot of that, plus some of my other material, so it was a really fun show to line up.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And we start working tomorrow with Hondro.
That's so exciting. I can't wait for that.
Hondro will be flying in at 5 today, so we'll be hearing him bitching.
Oh, yes. About I hope he gets in on time.
Yeah, well, he's in L.A. now.
Oh, okay.
Mid to L.A., so he's got to get from L.A. to Vegas.
Yeah.
Because there's not a direct flight from Spain to Vegas, I guess. I guess there's not, yeah.
And so you're saying we're leaving from here, we're going to a celebration of life.
Yeah, for Perry. And I was just saying I'm so uncomfortable with celebrations of life.
I was thinking about this.
I mean, it's good practice for Emily to be a widow, but other than that.
She's getting her laps in.
Yeah.
No, I was thinking that I had the same feeling. That like, I was like, I, but then I realized I went to a lot of funerals as a child. So maybe it's just a childhood nostalgia that I like funerals. There is a wave to be anti-traditional funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I like the most and what I still want to have happen at the event we're going to is I just want stories. Like the best thing that happens at a funeral is everyone kind of just unloads all their stories about the person who died. And I like those stories.
But you know, when we went to Johnny's celebration of life, I don't remember any stories. I just remember crying.
Right. Yeah, you know, there were some good stories.
And there was that amazing beat poem that they did that I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the three Texas guys did.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
That was really nice.
That was
really
cool. His three sons, so to speak, of magic. Yeah. That was really nice.
That was
the guy who was not a magician, was kind of a mafioso guy who basically, when you always ask whether a guy's card count or not,
yeah,
whether that's always a bunch of bullshit from a magician or not, mm-hmm, had a dynamite story of Johnny walking to a room he should not have been in and having to do magical tasks. And I love that story.
I don't know that story.
Oh, yeah. I guess two mafiosos. But the guy was being, you know, cagey, beautifully and stereotypically cagey about the backgrounds of the people that were meeting. But they needed a poker hand to go a certain way, and they brought in Johnny, and Johnny helped rectify a situation by making a poker hand go the right way. And I was like, oh, so one guy does have an actual story of doing a thing like, oh, don't get in a poker room with you, you know? Like, Johnny had an actual story of that.
Well, you know, Johnny, and Johnny said yes to everything. That's what I remember most. Everybody's story was like, we asked Johnny if he could do that. Can you go to China and write a new show for this guy? Yeah. And that was, you know, that's what I hope that my children learn the most from Johnny Thompson. Is just say yes.
Yeah.
You know, and they seem to have learned that fairly well.
Well, the best thing for Johnny's celebration of life was the most authentic teller talking joke, and the funniest one ever made was that you went to speak, you couldn't, and you said, you talk, teller. And teller came in to talk, and the whole audience was like, oh, it's that joke we all make, but it's really happening.
Yeah,
and it was the most genuine and by far the funniest, because it was so genuine.
I couldn't speak.
You could not.
I could not speak. No. LOD points out, which is, I wish she'd never said this.
Yeah.
Said, the problem is when you break down at a funeral or a celebration of life, that you've taken all the attention off the person and put it all on you.
Oh, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's tough to say. I always think, because I've been asked to eulogize a few times, and I always think that what's weird is you have to postpone your grieving. Like when you have to run the show and you have to say.
But there's another way to do it, which is you can always go out and say, you know, what I liked most about X was he realized I was so much better than Penn and Teller and Copperfield. Remember that one? You remember that one?
I do. Yeah. No, it's unforgettable, right? Because one person, we were saying, because this person had a reputation, we were guessing what they would say.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, for the first like 2 minutes, it wasn't that. And I was like, maybe I was being such a dick before this event began. And then, just like a light switch, it turned. And it was beyond worse than anything you were saying before the funeral. And so, right, yeah. I think as long as that's the bar, I'm pretty sure I can be safe today for anything that might be said. So that's true.
You know, the best thing about Perry Friedman was that he realized how brilliant I am. I have a video here of him saying I'm better than all of you.
He told me. Get out the video.
Yeah, I'm going to
want to record this.
I'm going to play the video of him saying that Ben Gillette is better than you. All of you individually who are here. That he liked me more.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we should be doing. But we're going to head over.
Yes.
And see what this is. I guess it's already started. Started at 1. So
all right, we'll be the last in the ball pit.
We'll head over. And I will tell you that this is brought to you by Masterclass.com. If you want to do lifelong learning, you want to become a member, learn from over 180 instructors, learn really, really good stuff. Right now, you can get 15% off at Masterclass.com/pen. That's Masterclass.com/pen. And you get 15% off. You really should do it. It's a wonderful thing. Masterclass.com/pen.
I just started Amy Poehler's. I love it.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that next week.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, that was Penn Sunday School brought to you by Masterclass. Cha-cha-cha, and you become naked. That's so important. It's so important that you become naked. Remember that. By the way, that's from Revolution Number 9. People ask me why I say that. And it's Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah.
The poet stands naked on stage. And Revolution Number 9 by the Beatles, You Become Naked. That's where it's from. No. And you know we love you. And hey, Matt Donnelly, I'm glad you showed up. You got anybody to thank?
I do. That's why I'll drive anywhere to thank these following patrons who keep our show going and keep ready and able to go to the hospital if we need to. I want to thank Josh Zero. Stop misgendering Moxie on the podcast 2024, but do whatever in 2025. No, I added that last part. Ben, Amy Smith, Franzie, Harry the Gorillagician, Don Dottie, Kevin Burke, David McLaughlin, Old Bear Greg, Charlie Sheet says trans rights. No shit, Sherlock. And Por Favor Ven and Puerto Rico. Steve Bricegirdle says, who the hell gave Penn a keyboard and why didn't they do it sooner? Coach Rat Bastard, Wash Your Sister Sauce, Will Jason, David I Want to Finger Your Cunt Brenner, Tristan Connett, Mason Gooch, Sagebrush, Matthew Mishu, Luke Mellon, Jason Andrew Davidson, Peter B. Clark, Matt Williams, Soapy Fresh, Brad Sherlag, Mike Cavanaugh, Rafiki, Steve Feldman, Jonathan P., NewRuleFX.com, Eric M. Ryan, Danny Insert Meta Joke Here Ruse, Little Mandar, MDM. I don't like that the Patreon has limited characters to 50. That's all one word. Adam Stickney, Nathan Julian, Jeremy in Shanghai, Chris Harris, Petty Officer Scoop, Daniel Leanne Rhymes. No, it doesn't.
I like that one every time.
William Wangerine, David K., Sean Brevik, Blue Drinks Film says, please tell the TCFE story again, and Brandon Knapp. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.